Thank you very much indeed, and of course I'm honoured and delighted to be here on such a fantastic evening, if nothing else, for the weather. I suggested to Lara that we should have a barbecue instead of a talk, but apparently we've taken too much organising. I'm interested to talk tonight about how experiments become immortal, about how ideas survive over very long times. I want to talk about the long lives of ideas and institutions, and I want to do that by looking at the material artifacts that make ideas real. And I think it's impossible not to think about the long lives of institutions and ideas here. For instance, Trinity Boy Wharf, this site founded two centuries ago and only relatively recently stopped making the buoys and lighthouses and chains. But it's still here and still being used, and ideas are living on. Just along the water, the East India Dock, again founded 200 years ago, still here. It's no longer one of the docks for this country, but the ideas of mercantile trade are still very much living. And the East India Dock is still very much living. But, I mean, none of that. Trinity House, the parent body of Trinity Boy Wharf, was founded 500 years ago, in the 16th century. I mean, half a millennium ago, and Trinity House is still going strong today. Ideas and institutions do have long lives, and they can last for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the theme for tonight's talk, just at the top of the hill over there in Greenwich, the Royal Observatory, domestic scale, humble set of buildings, founded over 330 years ago in the 17th century, and still going strong today. I'm also interested in whether ideas can get destabilized, whether they can get dematerialized, whether people might try to kill an idea by literally attacking the artifacts. But I'm going to start with a nice simple local history story. I'm a curator, local history. So you've doubtless been along. I'm not going to compete with them all night. If you go along to the East India Dock, which if you came by DLI, you probably passed through, you can easily see the Royal Observatory from there. You can see it here before the O2 was built. And there it is, about 100 years ago, at the top of that hill, just around here. And it still looks like that now, a century later, even if the dress has changed a little. But the story that I want to tell tonight, it's a real life episode. It really happened in 1894, to start this talk. And it was an episode that was so shocking that we're still feeling the effects of it today. It was an attempt to blow up the Royal Observatory, on top of that hill. And specifically, I believe it was an attempt to blow up the clock at the gatepost of the Royal Observatory, and the standards of linear measure, which are also on display outside the Royal Observatory to this day. So I'm going to tell you the story of how one man tries to blow these two things up. And the fall guy in this story is this young man, Marshal Borodin, born in France in 1868. In his teens, he learned tailoring. By 1884, he was working as a tailor in Paris. But also in his teens, he became an anarchist. And also in 1884, he was sentenced to 2 months in prison for attempting to organize an anarchist meeting. 1884 is also the year that a conference was held in Washington, D.C., called the International Meridian Conference. And that conference in the States chose Greenwich, chose here, as the prime meridian of the world, as the reference point from which all time and space would be measured. Now, that decision at that conference in 1884 didn't go down well all around the world, it has to be said, and it was strongly opposed in particular by the French delegates. And then 3 years after that, Marshal Baudin, the anarchist, moved to London and joined an anarchist club that met in a street off Tottenham Court Road. And by 1894, he was 27 years old, he was small in stature, fair hair, fair moustache, blue eyes, described by acquaintances as quiet, reserved, secretive, devoted to the anarchist cause but lacking in personal affection. And then on the 15th of February 1894, he blew himself to death by mistake here outside the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, just up that hill. Two of the assistants who were working at the Royal Observatory that day, they were working in one of the computing rooms that overlooks the northern reaches of Greenwich Park. They were working away. The reports afterwards put this at about 4:45 in the afternoon on that day. Also on site besides the assistants was the gate porter, and all three of them heard the explosion. In fact, it could be heard across Greenwich. This photograph was published at the scene a couple of days afterwards. The three men hurried towards the windows of the observatory, the railings outside the observatory and other vantage points. Smoke was seen rising from the trees near the observatory's front terrace. And all three of them ran towards the explosion site. First on the scene were two local schoolboys from Greenwich School. And at the site of the explosion, they found a man, later identified as Marshal Baudin, kneeling on the path by the railings, by these railings, perfectly still. His head was bowed. The park keeper on duty that afternoon, he was the next to arrive, and then the men from the observatory came, and at that moment, Baudin was seen to sink to the ground. The park keeper lifted him gently upright and spoke to him. "What have you done?" There was no answer. One of the astronomers later described the scene. "The sight that presented itself was pitiable in the extreme. A wretched-looking specimen of humanity with his left hand clean blown off just above the wrist and the sinews and tendons hanging down like bits of cord. And a careful examination of the ground around led to the discovery of numerous pieces of flesh and bone over the surrounding area. Bone was seen protruding through a jagged hole in the back of his coat. And when the doctor opened his jacket, he reported that he found his bowels blown in." A newspaper soon after offered a similarly pitiful account. "On reaching the corner of Greenwich Park, a quiet suburban district, the police had found, amid a motley debris of trees, bushes and railings, the charred and shattered remains of a man. He tried to run or crawl back down the hill, back down towards the main road through the park, but he had more than 3.5 pounds of metal, having penetrated his intestines and liver, so he didn't get very far. Remember, this is a true story, and all of this was reported in this much detail in the press. One of the boys was sent to the Dreadnought Seamen's Hospital in Greenwich Town Centre to fetch a doctor. At this point, Gordon spoke for the first and last time and murmured that he wanted to be taken home. Take me home, fetch me a cab." Well, a cab wasn't what he needed. The gathered party took him to hospital where he died 25 minutes later from shock and loss of blood, and he never said what happened. This is a photograph of the observatory wall at the top of the path of the previous photograph. And apart from damage to the face of one brick on this wall, it was entirely unharmed by the bomb. The three men returned to the observatory, performed a search of the area. Now, this is from the Home Office files in the Public Record Office. This is a Home Office artist's sketch of the scene. It looks kind of childlike, but that is the official artist's representation of the scene as discovered by the police. Now, if you look closely, trace that zigzag path up, you might just see the letter A, the letter B, and five X's. there's a couple of Indian overgrowth there. The legend at the bottom of this drawing reads as follows. Letter A. This is where approximately the explosion took place. The letter B. This is where the man was found and still heavily stained with blood. X, 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 X. Pieces of hand found. The news hit the headlines of deadly force days afterwards. The Illustrated London News concluded that a Frenchman named Marshal Bourdin had, fortunately for mankind, killed himself unintentionally with the vile and dreadful instrument that is in vogue among them for their absurd and monstrous schemes. All of the gruesome details were quickly released, and hordes of tourists flocked to Greenwich Park to view that scene, where they could inspect white stakes that had been placed in the grass that marked the site where pieces of his hand and other particles had been found. One parkkeeper said that there were more visitors to Greenwich Park then than ever before. A report in the newspaper stated that considerable excitement prevails in Greenwich and large numbers of people are visiting the scene of the explosion. The significance of Greenwich time and the work of the Royal Observatory in this period can't be overstated. I mentioned that in 1884, the International Meridian Conference in Washington had selected Greenwich, had selected here, to be the location of the prime meridian for the world. And I mentioned that France was particularly angered by this, and in fact they refused to recognise the results of the conference, to recognise that Greenwich Mean Time would be the time for the world, until many, many years later. Because they and others saw it as an act of imperialism on the part of the already extremely imperial United Kingdom. And you can kind of see the point. I mean, whatever the reason in practice for Greenwich being selected as the basic time for the world, actually it was all about chips, charts, and convenience. In practice, in principle, it may well have looked like Britain was attempting to impose its values, literally impose its values, on the rest of the world. And that, I think, could look awfully like colonisation. Now, the conference in 1884 didn't result in immediate action. In fact, it took until the early 1890s for most countries in the world to shift to a Greenwich-based time system. And so by early 1894, when that bombing went occurred, far from the conference being 10-year-old history, in fact, it was very much in news headlines, it's still very current. And the connection between the Greenwich Observatory and wounded French pride was made at the time in the press. The Times stated that. The fact that the reputation of Greenwich Observatory is worldwide, and that Frenchmen have rather an objection to its preeminence, may have been influential in the mind of that Frenchman, who was clearly fairly educated. Then, as now, I think, it was impossible to separate science from society, to see the work of any institution as purely scientific, rather than bound up in politics, bound up in the wider culture. So bombing the Royal Observatory could have been seen as a strike against science, or it could have been seen as an act of revenge for that seemingly imperial act of dictating the time and cartography for every place on Earth. The clock outside the Royal Observatory still there. Also these linear measures. You could take your foot rule and lay it on the pegs there and see whether it's the right length. The linear measures for this country were outside then as now. And the leader writer of the Illustrated London News after Bourdin exploded his bomb wrote this: I cannot but think it was the observatory which was the object of Bourdin's expedition. For minds of a certain calibre, the destruction of the observatory would have all the relish of a national insult. Perhaps he might have been going for the linear measures set up on the wall. So I'm interested in what happens when you disagree with an idea. You can destabilise it by attacking the object. So My point here is that ideas can live or die by their material expression. Many of you will doubtless be aware and familiar with Joseph Conrad's 1907 novel, The Secret Agent. It was written as a subtle study of espionage and anarchy in Edwardian England. One of his darkest novels, and describes one of the greatest novels of the 20th century, is a depiction of a terrorist underworld in London at the time of the Edwardians, the turn of the 20th century, and its influences range from Dickens to Dostoevsky. And it revolves around a Russian anarchist named Verlov, living in Soho, who decides to provoke the middle classes by planting a bomb in a prominent public place in London. In the book, he discusses possible locations for this bomb outrage with another anarchist, and they were thinking big. Instead of hitting people in a restaurant or a theatre, as the anarchists have been doing for a little while thus far, they want to destroy something pure, something abstract. They wanted to destroy an idea. One of them suggested blowing up art. He said, a bomb in the National Gallery would make some noise. The other one said, but it would not be serious enough. There would be some screaming, of course, but from whom? Artists, art critics and such like, people of no account. Nobody minds what they say. But what about science? What do you think of having a go at astronomy? There could be nothing better. The whole civilized world has heard of Greenwich. The very bootblacks in the basement of Charing Cross Station know something of it. Yeah. The blowing up of the first meridian is bound to raise a howl. Go for the first meridian. There is nothing better. In the book, Verloc's brother-in-law, Stevie, blows himself up outside the Royal Observatory, and the whole premise was based explicitly on that real-life attack by Marshall Gordon that I've described 30 years earlier. And yet it survived. The Observatory survived. The clock kept ticking. Nothing really changed. I want to talk about the ideas that Marshall Gordon was attempting to destabilize, attempting to destroy. I want to talk about the beginning of time. I want to talk about the origin of Greenwich Mean Time, a 17th century experiment that turned into a 19th century anarchist abomination, that turned into a 21st century apparent fact of life, Greenwich Mean Time. Observatory was founded in 1675 with one job to do, to map the stars above Greenwich, above here in these skies, to solve the longitude problem. The longitude problem was about ships knowing where they were when they were at sea. Very, very practical problem. The Royal Observatory wasn't founded for some abstract blue sky stargazing. It was specifically to map the stars, and here's one of the star maps that resulted, to solve a practical problem here on Earth, which was ships crashing into land or running out of supplies because they didn't know where they were. And in about two generations, that problem was dealt with. The skies had been mapped, the stars were listed in giant star catalogs, the longitude had been solved. What then? So the Royal Observatory, which was built as a home for mapping the stars for maritime trade, turned into a centre for exporting time. Ultimately, as we've seen, it became a global reference mark for all of time and space. I mean, so the old experiment had concluded, the experiment for solving the longitude, but the physical institution that it had created, the bricks and mortar, the staff, the instruments, the ideas, demanded survival. And having been called into being, the physicality of Greenwich, the Royal Observatory, Greenwich Mean Time, served, I think, to keep those ideas alive. It was about creating a new reason for being once the longitude was solved, a new use for measuring time and space. And it was about making sure that that idea of accurate time, of precise time, of quick time, if you like, could spread its tentacles over Britain and ultimately over the entire world. And that idea was about standardizing time for an increasingly time-ordered society. The standard story of standardizing time is that it was all about railways. This is Euston Station. This was Euston Station. One of the first mainline railway stations in London, built in the 1830s. And here's the story. So if you're building railways, especially ones which run east or west, whose time do you put on the timetables for the stops at every station along the line? Because the time born of the sun differs as you go east or west. Of course, as the Earth rotates uniformly on its axis, we know that the time west or east of here is different by the sun. So the time before standard time, whose time is on the timetable? Do you reset your watch at every station on the way to Bristol or Bath? Answer, yeah, until they decided that this is mad. We should standardize, we need to pick one time. And you know what, because this is the modern age, because we're building railways, because we're shrinking time and space, it really doesn't matter that the time on the timetables, and ultimately the time on our watches and clocks, the time we live our lives by, isn't matched by the time above us. We'll pick one time, and we'll all keep to that, because it makes life easier. Whose time are we going to pick? Well, just about that time, the Royal Observatory in Greenwich was looking for a new reason to be. It was looking for a new point. And just at the same time also the electric telegraph was being developed, which enabled time to travel at the speed of light anywhere you could put an electric wire. And strangely enough, telegraph wires were being put alongside every railway for messaging, for signalling. But wouldn't it be great if you could flash the time, the speed of light, down those wires, east, west, wherever you can put a wire, Greenwich time would go. Seems quite seductive, actually. And so that was one reason why we started as a country to standardize to Greenwich time, why Greenwich Mean Time is the time that we keep. It's fine here by the sun, but you go anywhere else and it's not the time. But we were happy with it. And so the railways kind of increased their grasp on our society. And the story goes that, you know, after just a few years, by let's say 1850, everyone kept Greenwich time in this country. Not true, actually. My detailed and indeed exhaustive research on your behalf as taxpayers, thank you very much, and it was awful. I had to do a lot of research in London pubs. Exhaustive, extensive research in London pubs. This is a scene from 1895. I got very interested in the pubs because I was trying to look for a reason why we standardized in this country to Greenwich time, because as I read more and more, I realized that it wasn't the railways entirely. The railways could have had their standard time, but the time on our clocks and towns and villages could have been local time, could have been the time by its sun. And I started reading about the 1870s and the 1880s and the 1890s in the London pubs, and how it became a moral good to standardize time, because by standardizing time, you could standardize behavior. And the Victorians, in particular, made great use of that. So the reason why we stopped drinking at 11 o'clock in the pubs now, in 2011, drinking up time, it isn't because of drinking hours, because of the munitions factories in the First World War, as I used to think. In fact, the time controls on drinking went way further back to the 1870s, to the 1880s. It was about controlling us as citizens, making us better people, making us less drunk, making us temperate, by putting temporal controls on our drinking. Because for a liberal Victorian democracy, telling people not to drink, that wasn't politically acceptable. But putting temporal limits on drinking was fine, because it was kind of liberal. It wasn't the government telling people not to drink, it was time itself. And so the idea of GMT, the idea of standard time, as measured by the stars above us here, became in the 19th and 20th century a set of concrete material interventions in our lives, and it's still with us now. The idea of standard time is embedded using material artifacts, twitching telegraph needles, copper wires, steel rails, gigantic aerials, as you'll see, tubular bells, Gothic clocks, switches, relays, public houses, and one damn thing after another. Material, concrete manifestations of standard Greenwich time in our lives. I'm going to show you how the time got to our lives from the stars above Greenwich. And so the stars were being mapped by the astronomers with their fantastic telescopes, and to do that well, they needed to know the time. Because they had the finest telescopes, they could keep the time. The time, basically 24 hours, has elapsed when you see the same star in the crosshairs of your telescope, which is pointing straight upwards, right? That means the Earth has spun once, and you see the same star again. Divide that into 24 hours, 60 minutes and 60 seconds, and do that using a clock like this. This was the standard clock at Greenwich. Fantastic picture, I think. You can see that it was really important that the temperature was controlled right, and the pressure, because it was a pendulum clock, it was a physical artifact, it was a piece of metal swinging backwards and forwards, and the length of it changed time. And so you can see heaters and fans and all sorts of gorgeous things, if you're me. And then it would send its time electrically. So we've got the stars above correcting that clock, and then that clock sent its time electrically to this desk and that chap. And all of those galvanometers and telegraph instruments were the Greenwich Time Desk. That was the control station to the heart of what became the international network of Greenwich Time Signals. That's it. That's British. And that guy was in charge of, you know, the line that went to the time ball on the roof of the Royal Observatory, set up in 1833, and after this electrical system was installed in the 1850s, dropped automatically by electricity, by the future. And that's still going, that's still keeping time accurately. There it is, a little bit more recently. Now, after 175 years, it's still going strong. You can certainly watch by it. If you stand on the East India Dock with a pair of binoculars, you can see it drop, just as it did in the 19th century. A tourist attraction, then as now. Edwardians watching the ball rise at the Royal Observatory. Halfway up the mast, you'll probably know how it works, halfway up the mast, the ball is hoisted at 5 minutes to one in the afternoon. A visual signal for all around, for the sailors in the East India Dock to get ready with their telescopes. At 2 minutes to one, it was hoisted all the way to the top, sat on the latches. And then at the instant of 1 o'clock GMT, electricity pulled the latches away, the ball dropped smartly. 1 o'clock. And all of the sailors could set their chronometers right and set sail, knowing that they had perfect Greenwich time. But anybody else in London would do the same, as it started to seep into our society. After it went to the time ball, it then went to the gate clock, the first clock in the world to show Greenwich Mean Time to the public directly. Set in that war in 1852, the symbolic master clock for Britain, the clock that Bourdin tried to blow up in 1894. Still ticking, still accurate after 150 years. Things survive, ideas survive. And then from the Royal Observatory, the time was sent on telegraph wires to Lewisham Station on the South Eastern Railway. Then it went to London Bridge, where it met a giant chronopher, or time sender, a gigantic switch box which took Greenwich time and sent it wherever it was needed, along more and more electric wires. This is Queen Victoria Street in the City of London. And if you look at the top of the rooftops, you can see a whole clutch of telegraph wires. Many of those wires were carrying Greenwich time signals, switches, impulses, because there was a Greenwich time vendor on that street, a company which made its living by reselling Greenwich time on more and more telegraph wires to make more and more needles twitch, more and more little time balls to drop, and for Greenwich to snap. It was keeping the idea of the Royal Observatory alive. I mean, you might imagine this clock as ancient and timeless with its Gothic architecture, but in fact it was built in 1859, more recently, actually by 7 years, than the electrical modern time system at the Royal Observatory. So this is the Arrivist. This is the new kid on the block. And Big Ben couldn't escape the clutches of GMT. An electrical wire was sent all the way from the Royal Observatory to the clock room of Big Ben to make sure that the people looking after Big Ben, keeping it on time, were keeping it on Greenwich time. And it even was forced to report back every hour its own timekeeping to the clock wranglers at the Royal Observatory, who then published charts showing just how accurate Big Ben was. For many, many years, in fact, nothing could escape. And the chain continued. In the 20th century, wireless began taking some of the work of wired communication on. And in 1922, the BBC was born. The idea of accurate, standardized, quick, precise Greenwich time at a distance had by then been literally domesticated by the time this advert was printed. This is saying, as we hear the radio time check in our wireless, in our living room, we knew that we were really hearing Big Ben. And when we were hearing Big Ben, we were really hearing the Royal Observatory and the stars above. The BBC first broadcast from a transmitter on the roof of Selfridge's. This is the transmitter on the roof of Selfridge's department store. That is where the BBC broadcast for just a few years. And right from the start, they knew that they should be broadcasting accurate time into the homes of all of the listeners in. This is Arthur Burroughs, who was the chief announcer of the BBC, and the presenter, and the engineer, and the cleaner, and the receptionist. There weren't very many staff at the BBC. And behind them, you can see a set of tubular bells. The idea of making time on percussive instruments is, of course, nothing new. The tubular bells there, specially tuned to the Westminster chime. The studios there were on the banks of the River Thames, just along from the Houses of Parliament, just along from Big Ben. And what they used to do was open the windows, and when the wind was blowing in the right direction, is that Big Ben idea? And then they would play along with Big Ben in these tubular bells, into the microphone, into the homes of the nation. Remarkable. I can see, etched in your faces, you're thinking, well, that's all very well, David, but what about the speed of sound? Surely there would be some kind of delay if they're listening to the sound of Big Ben and then playing up. Well, you're absolutely right, and well done, and what a fantastic audience you are. I can see that I'll get nothing past you tonight. I decided to get my ruler out and find out just what kind of delay would be going out on the BBC's time signal back in 1922. So I measured how far the studio window was from the Houses of Parliament, from Big Ben. And I found out that the time had been going out by the BBC 2.5 seconds late. Now, that was then. Of course, now in the 21st century, there isn't a chance, is there, that the BBC would be broadcasting what's meant to be an accurate time signal 2.5 seconds late. Because we've had progress since then. Yeah, digital radio. If you listen to digital radio and compare it with an analog radio, it is going out 2.5 seconds late. And when you hear the pips on the BBC, on digital, they are going out 2.5 seconds late. I'm kind of trying to say that progress is a strange thing, and that sometimes we don't move forwards. So, there are two of the bells. But in 1924, it was realised that listening for Big Ben playing along wasn't the modern way, it wasn't the electrical way. And so the six picts were then founded, which took the time directly from the Royal Observatory, from a clock set up specifically for that purpose, which sent six electrical impulses down the telephone wire all the way from that hill to the BBC, where they were turned into picts and broadcast. No chapel, no fugue of bells, just modernity, just a direct connection from the stars of Greenwich to your home. Unless you're listening on digital. Now, you might have automatically radio-controlled clocks and watches. You might have you can get these things from Argos, you know, a 20-quid kitchen clock, but it sets itself right from a radio time signal. Or you might have a wristwatch that does that. Originally, those codes came from a place called Rugby. You can set your watch or clock right by the codes today. They're still a broadcast, although from Cumbria, not from Rugby. But originally, of course, they originated from the Royal Observatory. And this is another room full of clocks at the Royal Observatory, which sent its Greenwich time to there, to Rugby. This is one of the Rugby radio station transmitter masts. Now, this was literally taking the materialisation of Greenwich Mean Time to huge lengths. Rugby radio station has 12 masts. This is the base of just one of them. 12 masts, 200 tons of steel in each mast. The masts were there to string a single wire around an area enclosing 900 acres. There were 300 miles of wire across Rugby radio station, all told. This is the view from the top of one of those masts. He looks a little bit worried, I think. So what this is from a 17th century southeast London hilltop observatory, domestic, modest, mapping the stars to help the ships at sea, a big idea. To this materialisation in the 20th century, a single standard mast of time for the entire world, and a vast infrastructure to do so. To shift time from Greenwich to the world. And this still keeps going on strong after 85 years. What I'm saying is there's been a huge material intervention in Britain and across the world to keep alive the idea of Greenwich Mean Time as a standard. The world is physically different now in so many ways because of the actions and ambitions of people at Greenwich and elsewhere. And of course the world's physically different. A single standard time for the world is a massive idea. If you design that from scratch, you have to give up immediately. Because how on earth can you ever imagine making such a huge set of material changes to the world if you were a 17th century astronomer in a room there? But it happened. It does happen. It can happen. It did happen. Individual people can have ideas. And then they get built on, and then they materially change the world over time scales of centuries. Of course, I'm alluding now to long play. Individual people can have ideas, they can be built on, they can materially change the world over time scales of centuries. I'll finish with Jem's work in a little while, but before I do, I want to look at one more historical episode in the socio-politics of. Strangely enough, seems to be a pub again. We're staying in southeast London because these are local history stories. And let me take you to the Daylight Inn, I mean, not literally, let me take you in this talk to the Daylight Inn, which is a pub in Pexwood near Bromley. This picture was taken in 1935. If you take a close look at the sign, you'll see two clock dials. And one of them is set to 12 o'clock and one of them is set to 1 o'clock. So that sign is still there, it's been repainted. And this is about daylight saving time, right? This is about putting the clocks forward in the summer. And this pub commemorated it. Putting the clocks forward in summer, what a concept! What a concept! Literally saving time, literally making time longer. Every year, newsreaders sit there when we put our clocks forward and say, we are going to get an hour more daylight. We aren't, by the way, I can tell you that. Isn't it absolutely remarkable that every year, twice a year, we all humbly submit to this instruction to change the hands on every clock and watch in the country. Isn't that mad? Isn't it crazy that we're physically changing the hands on every single clock and watch in this country? Because somebody tells us that we'll get more daylight? That's an incredible state of affairs. The idea of that was put forward in 1907. It was enacted in 1916, and we've been doing it ever since. And why do we do it? We do it simply so that we get up 1 hour earlier in summer. Because there's more daylight in summer, and it's better to be up and about in the daylight rather than sleeping through the first hour of it. That's why we change the clocks every year. Actually, when you think about that, that's another Victorian moral concept, is it not? That getting up and about in nature, in sunlight, in the fresh air, is good for us. And we're still doing it. Don't get me wrong, I'm all for getting up early. I like daylight. But I just think it's rather startling that for a century, the only way we have found to get up earlier and enjoy all of this daylight is to reset the hands on every single clock and watch in this country. Rather than, I don't know, just getting up early. Now that's what I'm talking about, and I'm talking about making ideas concrete so that they survive. Getting ideas into the minds of people by repeated performance. It's not just Britain that changes the clocks for summertime. I've worked this out. 1/4 of the population of the Earth live in countries which change every clock and watch twice a year for a daylight saving scheme. 1/4 of the population of the Earth change their clocks and watches twice a year to get up earlier. I'm fine, but kind of a bit harsh. And it's this guy's fault. William Willett, a southeast Londoner, he lived not too far away from here, and he had the idea. In fact, he had the idea on horseback with his daughter Gertrude at their Chislehurst home, pictured here, a Chislehurst home called the Cedar. And Gertrude, who's the girl on the horse there, later described the scene. Every morning before breakfast, my father rode through Pett's Wood, which then stretched unbroken towards Orpington from the commons of St. Paul's Cray. There were beautiful bridle paths leading through the woods under pine trees. It was here that my father first thought of daylight saving. Now, he wasn't the first to have the idea that we should get up earlier in summer because we've got more daylight. The first in print was Benjamin Franklin in 1784, who proposed always getting up at sunrise. And he said this in a pamphlet: "Every morning, as soon as the sun rises, let all the bells in every church be set ringing to wake the sluggards and make them open their eyes." But the idea of changing clocks to do that was Willett's. In 1907, he said, "Nearly everyone has given utterance to a regret that the clear, bright light of early morning during spring and summer months is so seldom seen or used." He put his idea to Parliament. Select committees examined his proposals. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle gave evidence at one of these. He said this rather patronising comment: "It is a splendid thing for every man in summer to get back to his home in time to look after his little garden after his day's work." But it was controversial even then. A former astronomer royal said this: "Are people going to be cheated into getting up earlier in the morning, or are they to get up honestly earlier?" But we Winston Churchill was a strident supporter of Willett's scheme. He said in 1911, "An extra yawn some morning in the spring, an extra snooze some night in the autumn, is all we ask in return for the most dazzling benefits." He went on, "We borrow an hour in April, we promise to pay it back with golden compound interest 6 months later." William Willett didn't live to see his scheme in action. He gave up his campaigning for daylight saving in 1914 at the outbreak of the First World War to concentrate on business interests. He had an interest in a bauxite mine in Spain, and he went out there to sort out a fraud that had been reported. And while he was out there in 1915, he contracted influenza. He hurried home and then died, aged only 58. And he's buried in Chislehurst here, actually very close to Sir Malcolm Campbell, also in the same churchyard. So he didn't see his daylight scheme enacted, but in April 1916, the following year, Germany started what it called Sommerzeit, summer time, and soon after, Austria-Hungary began changing the clocks, then Holland, then Denmark, then Sweden. And they wanted to do that because they thought they might get longer working hours of light in the munitions factories, and anything that might give them an edge in the war was seen as worth trying. And in this country, we saw that they've tried it, and even though we'd ignored it for years, we very quickly passed the Summertime Act, anything that might give us an edge in the war. And so on the 21st of May 1916, the first day of summertime began. There was some remarkable pavement graffiti seen on the first day of summertime in 1916 on a pavement near Fleet Street. "All Fools' Day, May the 21st. Get up 1 hour earlier and kid yourself if you haven't." But William Willett had done what he promised. He got people more daylight simply because society could not find any other way to get people up earlier in summer. And for that, he became a posthumous hero. And heroes are made immortal. And fundraising attempts to immortalise William Willett began in 1918, first appropriately perhaps for a memorial plot in Sloane Square, where his business was. And then when money failed to come in for that, a memorial oil painting, a little bit dark, I think, which was painted for Chelsea Town Hall. And that was unveiled in 1923, and that's now in a storage facility in Westminster, Chelsea's town hall somewhere. A sundial in Pett's Wood was unveiled. It's still there in the heart of Pett's Wood, a very nice walk if you want to go for a walk in Bromley. It reads permanent summertime around the other side. It's always 1 hour ahead. A bronze portrait bust was cast and unveiled in an art gallery in Colchester in 1926 by William Willett's daughter Gertrude, who we met earlier on horseback. That's now on show in an estate agent in Sloane Square, so believe it or not, Hampton's estate agents. And William Willett, the man responsible for a quarter of the world changing its time twice a year, even made it to that cathedral celebrity, Madame Tussaud's Waxworks. He was on show in 1931 through 1934 in this wax figure. Unfortunately, not there anymore in their collection. I presume that he's been melted down and now forms part of Jordan or something. And if you've ever been to Port Merion, the model town in Wales, which opened in 1926 by Clough Williams Ellis, the architect and some say visionary, you might see an armillary sphere high on a stone pedestal outside one of the cottages. Clough Williams Ellis was a huge fan of William Willett and what he'd achieved. In later life he said, "Though his lifelong efforts on our behalf were truly Herculean, they've been too little honoured. Not one in 20 of those who nowadays sit to rest beneath the astrolabe high on stone column knows a thing about him. A piece of ignorant ingratitude that needs correction." Years after his death, he'd been firmly cast as a hero. Winston Churchill in 1934 said, "Let us, as we put forward our clocks for another summer, drink a silent toast to the memory of William Willard. When you start looking for manifestations of William Willard's summertime scheme, never mind the hands on every clock and watch in a quarter of the earth, you start finding everywhere. I told you this was a local history lecture. This recreation ground in Peck's Wood opened, named after Willard, in 1948, even if then as now they couldn't spell his name right. There are even two streets named after Willard in the area, Willard Way and Willard Close. And you're probably thinking, will it ever end? Thank you. Well, I don't think it will, because I think this is about immortality. I think this is about the immortality of ideas through objects and through performance, and how even in the most violent circumstances, like a terrorist trying to blow up the Royal Observatory, the ideas survive. The clocks keep ticking. People keep caring and modifying. Stuff endures, and so do ideas for long, long times. I want to finish by looking, of course, at Jem's project. A project to make some ideas real, I think. And I think a project that's disrupting, but in the most gentle way, those centuries-old notions of standardized, scientifically precise timekeeping. Ideas that help us take a longer view. Now, the English playwright Christopher Marlowe in the 16th century said, "So enclose infinite riches in a small room." And standing upstairs in the lighthouse, listening along there, looking out across all of this history, is an experience that, in my view, is infinitely rich. The idea's been growing and growing since Longplay started playing nearly 12 years ago. There are listening posts around the world, and here we are talking about it and keeping those ideas real through performance, staying alive through repetition, through reinvention. In my view, Jem is disrupting an age-old idea of inflexible short time, Greenwich Mean Time. Mean, perhaps, is the word there. But disrupting it not with violence, but with absolute beauty. I don't want to labour the point, I just want to say that history relates that truth and ideas last, especially if they're made concrete, especially if they're performed. And so history will relate that we might not be here in the year 3000 when Longplay starts to repeat for the first time. But it will still be playing, and people like us will still be keeping those ideas alive. Bravo to Jem. Bravo to all of you here for changing the world with Longplay. But I think it probably feels like this talk's been going on for 1,000 years itself, so I'm going to shut up now and say thank you very much indeed for listening. Thank you. Usually about 15 or 20 grandfather clocks, and of course at noon they'd all start to strike 12, but of course they were antique clocks, so they'd all start striking at a different time, but usually spread out over about 10 minutes, so my friends knew that you never ran the house anywhere near me. Well, it's funny, actually. I was doing some of this research, and I haven't talked tonight about the telephone speaking clock, which is another interest of mine. How you can,
that's next year's talk.
Next year's talk, yeah. You can pick up the telephone and you can hear the time at Greenwich through the telephone whenever you want, and that's something that's been going since the 1930s. The research that I did was into the voices of the speaking clock. They had like an X Factor style competition in 1935 to find the girl and start a lecture now. And to start the girl with the golden voice, because if you're going to build a clock that talks to be listened to on the telephone, you need a voice, right? And so they had a competition amongst all of the telephone operators in Britain. And they were all whittled down in a series of auditions, regional peaks. I mean, Simon Cowell, he's not on anymore, is he? Nicky Hardhouse. And it got down to a heat of 9 finalists who came to London to a place just near St. Paul's Cathedral to audition. They had to read Milton's L'Allegro from the 17th century, all Twisted Eglantines, down like a golden telephone handset from another room into this grand hall in the post office headquarters. And one of the 9 finalists won. She was called Ethel. And she went on to be famous and an actress. And I was interested in the other 8. Now, the guy in charge, of the voice tests was the poet laureate at the time, and he hated regional accents. So I read all of the instructions of who's going to win, who's likely to win, and he did not like regional accents. And I was reading who these 8 finalists were. Don't worry, I'm nearly finished. And I was really surprised that one of them was a woman called Mary Dixon from the South Shields Exchange. And I thought, how come I never got taught at school in history that one of our local lasses, because I'm actually from the North East, you might not have realised that, I mean, I keep it hidden, was nearly the most listened to voice in 1930s Britain, until I read the poet laureate's report on all the finalists. In none of the finalists can any trace of a regional accent be found, except for one, and that was a northern one. And the point that I'm making is, I wrote this up, I sent it home to the man, and she read it, and she rang me up, and she said, you know that Mary Dixon? I said, I am. She said, you related to her. So I am genetically, ladies and gentlemen, I am genetically a Greenwich Time loser.
Do you have any questions?
Did they call time gentlemen when the Victorian started the time clocks? Was that the... Exactly right. So it's time gentlemen, please. Yes. It's so ingrained in us now that they ring the bell and you stop drinking. And yeah, and in that picture of the pub in 1895, there's a prominent clock.
Yes.
And that was because when they introduced this moralising drive to make us better people by drinking less, it was very important that there was a clock on the wall, because if the publican was going to lose the licence for serving liquor after hours, they needed to be able to point to a clock to say, no, this is connected to Greenwich by the electric wire. And so there was a huge industry in time distribution to pubs, and that's why I was sitting in pubs drinking on your behalf.
I'm very curious about the other 3/4 of the planet's population, because you said that a quarter of the population is changing.
I would normally draw a diagram, but because of the tilt of the Earth, you only get like a lot more daylight in summer rather than winter, or vice versa, if you're quite far north of the equator or quite far south of the equator. If you're near the equator, then daylight and darkness hours are pretty much uniform throughout the year, so there's no point in changing the clocks because you've got more daylight in summer. And so a lot of the countries in Africa and kind of around that belt, where there are huge populations, it doesn't make any sense to change. But I've counted up every country that does, and it's quite remarkable. That's my chair.
Yes, just one thing about this. You know, you say they wire time.
Yeah. That's hilarious. I mean, this was an industry.
So how much would it cost?
It's sad that I'm not able to answer that. Alright, so if you got your time directly from the Royal Observatory, so if you took a wire, you paid to have a wire from the top of that hill to Lewisham Station to London Bridge, and then directly to your premises. You pay £200 a year in today's money to get an hourly time signal. You can pay half that, sorry, £400. You pay half that, £200, to get a daily time signal. Or you can pay £100 to get a woman called Ruth Belleville to come and call on you. And Ruth Belleville took her pocket chronometer to the Royal Observatory every week and had it corrected and carried it around London, and you paid £100 a year for a weekly visit. So it wasn't all by wire, some of it was by handbag.
So this, the reseller they presumably
got it
cheaper.
Exactly. That reseller is called the Standard Time Company, and they sold it. They undercut both of those that I just mentioned, and they charged the equivalent of £85 a year. Their service was very interesting technically, but it hemorrhaged cash.
There's a book there.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. Actually, you sparked a memory in me. Actually, yeah, someone wrote a book about Ruth Belleville. I think it's called Ruth Belleville, the Greenwich Time Lady. But it's not all about that. £12.99 if you're interested. And we're coming for Christmas, but no.
David wrote a very interesting book.
How do you know around that same era how far around the world the time actually travelled?
That's an interesting question, and actually it's an interesting question about the speed at which changes happen. I've kind of presented a picture where everything, once it starts or is invented, it happens very quickly. So Greenwich was formed as this prime meridian, and then pretty much quickly everyone takes the time. It was much, much slower than that. But submarine telegraph cables were laid from the 1850s. So cables between this country and others, first France and Europe, and then across the Atlantic in the 1860s. So from the 1860s, the time from the clocks at that site, and I'll keep pointing at it, but it really is a local history story, the time from those clocks was being telegraphed under the ocean to the US.
One last question from Jimmy here.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if it's a question, but I'm quite interested in the idea standardized time itself as an artifact, as a museum piece, and that perhaps it doesn't need to be disrupted with art. Perhaps science disrupted it, you know, with the theory of relativity and just recent discoveries in terms of the speed of light. So I wondered if the idea of standardized time was just the flash in the pan, and that now we realize once again, or we come to realize that time is a relative thing rather than something, you know, constant.
I think that's a very important and useful point. I think what I'm seeing is kind of, you know, a parting of the ways, and the standardization of time is getting more and more precise, and there are clocks now being developed which far eclipse anything the observer could ever do, which are accurate to 1 second in the remaining lifetime of the universe. So if they were separating now, if they were still running in 15 billion years' time, they'd be wrong by less than a second. And so the standardization and the precision measurement of time with atomic clocks is profoundly more accurate, more scientific, and yet the ideas, the cultural ideas of relativity since Einstein have made us think in many social and cultural ways about time. And of course, here we are talking about alternatives to standardized time and quick time. So, art and thought and people modifying ideas over those like 300 years that I've mentioned are profoundly important.
Okay. Well, today is something of a hideous night. Thank you for coming. I hope you'll come next year when we have more talks. The bar is open. David will be available to help him with his further research, ask him further questions. Lord Player is playing. The bucket is playing.